Episode 291 of the Pilot the Pilot podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics, then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot. The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app. Aviation, there's a new offer from SiriusXM. Make sure you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your plane by getting the Garmin GDL52 portable receiver. The GDL52 has ADS-B traffic and weather plus SiriusXM weather and entertainment. It has Bluetooth and works with Garmin Pilot apps. For a limited time, you can get a $300 rebate on the GDL52, plus it comes with a free 3-month trial of SiriusXM's weather and entertainment. I love flying with SiriusXM, and it's honestly one of my favorite features about having the G5000, so the GDL52 will offer you a very similar outlook on the weather and also getting to listen to some awesome radio stations on SiriusXM. So check out the GDL52 at aopa.org/SiriusXM. Aviation, welcome back to the Pilot podcast. Today's episode is a re-release with Steve Randall. Steve is a former ferry pilot, and now he's an airline pilot captain at a major airline. The story is great. I love Steve. He's a great guy, a great mentor for people in aviation. So reach out to him on Instagram. He's an awesome guy. Aviation, make sure you check out the Bold Aviator Pilot to Pilot hats. Are the best hats in the game. This is a short intro today. That's all I got for you today. So without any further ado, here is Steve Randall. Steve, what's going on? Welcome to the Pilot podcast.
Well, it's nice to be here, Justin. Thank you. Having listened to almost 200 of these, that's it's quite thrilling to hear you say that, I have to say.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I cannot believe that there's been 200 of them. When I started this, I never imagined making more than like 5, to be quite honest. Like I thought either no one would listen and I'd be embarrassed and I'd just kind of give it up, or maybe it would just kind of, you know how people start new things and then just kind of, you do something else, you know? But for some reason, people listened and I just kept going. So here we are, 100, this will be 190, this will be 197 right here.
That's crazy. But there's a reason. I mean, it's you. You're very, very good at this, and it makes it very, very interesting. The people that you pick are very interesting, and I just hope that I can live up to your previous 196.
All the pressure in the world, man.
I know.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. It's everyone else. It's not me. So yeah, I appreciate everyone that came on and makes me look good. So, but let's get started in your story. I'm very intrigued, and I know we've been trying to do this forever and it's just kind of never really worked out, but here you are on a overnight and you are working and you gave me some time. So I appreciate it. So I don't want to waste any more of it, so you can go out and enjoy the day before you go flying. But why aviation? What was it for you that made you want to get into aviation at a young age or later in life, whenever you did?
Well, actually, I can pinpoint the exact moment when aviation came into my life. I was 9 years old, and I went on a school trip from the south of England out to one of the Channel Islands, which is just one of the islands off of the coast of France. And we were heading to Guernsey, and we were on an old Handley Page Herald, a high-wing twin-turbo prop, old 1960s airliner. And that didn't really get me very interested. It seemed cool. But I sat by the window right underneath the left wing. And we went into Guernsey, or we were on the approach to Guernsey. And we were in the clouds, and I could see clouds. And then we went around because obviously they didn't get the runway. There was a bunch of fog. And so then we diverted to another island called Jersey. And once again, I watched the wheels come down. I watched the flaps come down. And I was looking out, trying to find the runway. And to me, as a nine-year-old looking out of this window, what I saw was cloud, runway, land, in a split second. And it just consumed me. I just didn't know how they did it, how they found that runway. Because we were in the clouds, it didn't make any sense to me. And my mind started to run a million miles an hour. And I thought, well, I've got to go and ask the pilots. And so I purposely tried to stay on the airplane. To the pilots, how did you see the runway? And unfortunately, my teacher grabbed my arm and moved me rapidly to the back of the airplane. So I never got to see the pilots. But for that whole trip, I don't know what we did on that trip. I'm sure it was very interesting. But I just couldn't think of anything else except this, how did they see the runway? How did they do that? And it just consumed me. And then once we flew back to Southampton where we left from, the most enjoyable part of that trip was the flight, and that's the thing I was looking forward to. Now, unfortunately, I came from what would be the equivalent of a welfare upbringing in the US. So I was a council kid in the UK. So we had no money. So the thought of going and being able to take another flight and try and feed this this interest in aviation was just out of the question. But basically, from that point on, I just wanted to learn as much as I possibly could about aviation. And how these guys saw that runway, with all the fog over the island, pretty crazy.
Yeah. So, in that situation where you're this kid and you kind of have an idea, like you know the reality of how you grew up, and it probably wasn't going to lead you to becoming a pilot or being in that seat. Like you probably had in mind that it was going to be crazy expensive, or maybe it was just out of reach for someone, like you said, that grew up in the situation that you did. What did you do to, one, figure out the answer? How did they land? Like how early did you actually figure that out? Did you go to the library and get the books and figure it out? Or was it over time when you started taking your pilot lessons and started figuring out a way to become a pilot?
No, I did go to the library, and I got as many books as I could, and I think I sort of figured it out, but not quite. When I actually figured it out, my dad knew that I had this interest because I wouldn't stop talking about aviation, and so there was a new aviation museum that opened up in our hometown, and so he took me. And they had this big flying boat as the centerpiece. It was a four-engined Sandringham flying boat. And so, of course, I wanted to get up into the cockpit, and they were running tours that day. And so my dad and I went up into this Sandringham cockpit, and I sat in the pilot's seat. And the person giving the tour was a kid about the same age as me. And he was in this uniform, and it started to intrigue me. You know, how does this kid know about, you know, how does this kid have this knowledge about this airplane? So the uniform was the Air Training Corps, which was the junior Royal Air Force. And it just so happened that they had an Air Training Corps squadron attached to this museum. And as we then started to walk around the museum, a door to the squadron was left open. And so I peered in, and what I peered into was the simulator room. And they had a whole bunch of simulators. They had two of the old Link trainers, the old wartime movable simulators in there. They had a big Comet, de Havilland Comet simulator. And I just peered into this and saw a whole bunch of these air cadets in uniform flying these simulators. And that was it. From that point, I want to join the Air Training Corps. And this is now where I can learn all about aviation. And of course, what that did also, it led to an air experience flight. So that led to my first flight where I actually got to fly. The Air Training Corps would run air experience flights using old RAF trainers, de Havilland Chipmunks. And so I signed up for this, and went off one morning to Bournemouth Airport in the south of England, and almost threw up my breakfast. because I just didn't know what to expect. I'd filled my brain with so much knowledge, and I obviously was developing this passion for aviation. But now came the moment where I was thinking, well, if I go up and I don't like this, then what? You know, there's nothing after that. And so I was so nervous about going up, but not nervous, but of the fact that I might not like it, because I'd become so passionate about aviation. But as it turned out, I went up and absolutely loved it, and realized that this was something I could do. And so it, being a broke kid from a broke family, this was the obvious ideal way for me to go fly for a living, which is to join the RAF. Unfortunately, my eyesight wasn't good enough. So the RAF said, sorry.
Yeah, thanks, but no thanks. No, we appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, as much as I was trying to convince them that, hey, I'm England's next best fighter pilot. And they're like, no, sir. No good. Sorry. Go away. And then I was stuck in this limbo of, well, what do I do now? I can't afford to fly. The RAF won't allow me to fly. I have to do something. And I was looking for some direction. And I did bump into a few people that gave me some advice, some good, some bad. I followed most of it. The first thing I tried to do at the time, British Airways were running a cadet scheme, where they would take you from 0 hours and they would train you and you would join British Airways. And for that, you needed, these qualifications don't exist anymore, but back then it was 5, O level, exam results and 2 A level exam results. The O level would be the high school. Over here, it'd be high school, college, I suppose. And then the 2 A levels would be college, university level. And so from that point on, I was a very lazy student at school because it didn't seem that schoolwork was, it seemed like a waste of time. Absolute waste of time to me. But
you're not the only one that feels that way.
Right. But I thought, well, now I've got a purpose. Now I have a goal. I have to get these 5 O levels and these 2 A levels to be able to apply to this cadet program and go and fly for British Airways. And so I did pretty well at school. There were some subjects, and this is what happened. My brain decided which subjects would help me in my future career and which ones wouldn't. And if you look at my school report, the classes that I did well in are things that are related to aviation, you know, your sciences and your math and those kind of things. English literature, no, absolutely appalling, you know, because it seemed pointless. It's religious education, terrible, absolutely awful. And so I had this very mixed bag of results, but I did leave school with just about. I wasn't a prize student, but just about the right number of O levels to then move me on to college to get these 2 A levels. And it was one of those things where I just had to pick 2 subjects, and the subjects were just dull and boring. And didn't seem to relate in any way, shape, or form to flying airplanes. And so I was kind of losing the plot a little bit. My dad was a car mechanic, but he also on the side, he was quite a talented photographer, and he was photographing for an advertising campaign at a kitchen showroom. And the owner of this kitchen showroom was a former pilot. I know that because in his office, he had a photo of him in his uniform next to an airplane. And so, of course, I started to talk to him. Now, his advice was, yeah, forget about the college thing. You know, British Airways only take a very small number of people. And so if you now spend the next 2 years trying to get these grades, you're basically giving yourself a ticket to apply to something that you statistically have a very low chance of getting into. Why not go get a job and pay to get your private license and then approach the airlines already with some experience? That was his advice. Now, I'm not saying that's the best advice ever, but I took it. And so I quit college and I went and got a job. I first started out in a finance company and as a personal loans officer, which was quite ironic because being broke and terrible with money. Yeah, that was the first job. And then I got into doing some other credit related things. I kind of fell into finance and credit management and ended up working for a convenience store company as a credit manager. And this was great because at the time I was starting to earn a little bit of money and I was able to pay for some flying. The flying costs in the UK at that time were, as they still are, absolutely ridiculous and pretty much out of reach for me. But everything I earned, I put into flying, just to do an hour here and an hour there. And eventually I went solo. I did my 18 hours and I went solo and, then eventually I got my private. That was 10 years after I took my first flight. But I kind of found myself in this position of, I was actually getting more involved with the regular job. And I didn't seem to be doing too much flying. And other people that I knew were kind of getting on with the airlines and their careers were starting to move. And there was a big wake up for me where I just thought, you know, I'm doing as much as I can. I work, I earn, and I'm paying for as much flying as I possibly can. But I still got such a long way to go and I'm just wasting time here. It was right about that time that my aunt, who I was very close to, she had for her entire life, she never married, she was always single. Her entire life, she saved and saved and saved for one thing that she was going to do in her life, which was an around-the-world cruise when she retired. And so that's what she spent her life saving for. And just a few weeks before she was due to retire, I went to see her and she said, well, I'm not going to be taking my around the world trip. I have cancer. And they've said, I'm not able to travel and I may not be around to do it. Which was, a big shock at the time. The advice she gave me then was, don't you dare do what I did. You live your life now. Don't fall into the same trap. Don't wait. Just get on with it. And it was a real wake up, kick up the bum for me. And at the same time, of course, I already had these thoughts of, the progress here is just so slow. And I need to be getting on with this. Right about this time, and this is definitely not advice that I should give to anybody, but right about this time, I was getting just a crap load of credit card applications through the door. All of a sudden, the finance companies realized I was in that demographic of somebody that was earning some money and had a pretty decent credit record because I didn't really spend anything or
They wanted to spend was. Your money, huh?
Right.
Yeah.
And so I signed up for credit cards like crazy. I just signed up for so many credit cards and just thought, screw it. I'm just going to get on with it. I'll pay these back when I'm an airline pilot. This is the way I'm going to accelerate my flying career. I basically flew as much as I could. And at the time, the exchange rate between the US and the UK, the pound and the dollar, it pretty much worked in my favor that 1 hour of flying in the UK was almost equivalent to 2 hours in the US. And I thought, well, okay, this is pretty obvious. I need to go over to the US and build some hours. And so the internet was pretty new during those days, and I couldn't afford to make a phone call to the US. So I went to the library and went onto a computer and searched this new internet thing. And I found a website for a company that still exists, San Diego Flight Training International, SDFTI.com. I still remember it. And
was it the first one that popped up, or did you specifically search San Diego?
No, it was one of the first that popped up. That as soon as I looked at the website, it seemed to be very easy to read, and it very quickly answered a lot of questions that I had can I do this? I'm a UK citizen. Can I come over? Can I do this? And it answered those questions, and it seemed, there wasn't a lot of small print. It seemed pretty easy to read. And there was a way to contact them. So I contacted them and I said, look, I would like to come over for maybe 3 or 4 weeks and just max out as much as I can. So I want to fly multi-engine. I want to fly night. I want to get as much bang for my buck as I can. At that time, I already had I had a private multi-engine instrument in the UK. So they suggested, well, why don't we just do this as Part 61? Instead of flying around in circles, why don't we just aim for a commercial multi-instrument conversion? And I thought, well, that sounds great. Let's do that. And so off I trot to San Diego, and 3.5 weeks later, I have a commercial multi-instrument.
That's awesome.
Which was nuts.
Before you came over, was this in your mindset, was this, I'm going to temporarily come to the United States, get all my time, and then come back to the UK to go fly for British Airways, to go fly for whatever the airline was that piqued your interest? Or did you think, hey, I might be in the US for the rest of my life?
Oh no, there was absolutely no way I could be in the US. The US was purely to build hours. This was a grand plan and a great scheme to get hours. And so I would be coming back to the UK far more experienced with a commercial multi-instrument that I threw in the drawer. I'm not ever expecting to use it ever again. How could I? And so this was purely just to build hours at a much cheaper rate than in the UK. And it was just their suggestion of, let's make it fun. We may not be able to do it, but let's go down the road of a commercial multi-instrument. And it was so much fun. I just got on with it. I had a great instructor. The examiner was a really, really cool guy. And so at the end of the time there, I had this commercial multi-instrument with nothing to, I couldn't use it. So I just threw it in a drawer. But that would become quite useful later.
Yeah. I wanted to ask a question before we kind of keep going on down the path of what was next. But there's a lot of people that either get into aviation later, or maybe they need to work to get their hours, or maybe they just always had this goal, but like you, your job kind of consumed you. Your job kind of made your path to becoming a pilot seem not as realistic anymore, or all your friends are already getting hired as airline pilots and you just felt like you're falling behind just because you had to work and you had to make the money to pay and it just wasn't happening like you wanted it to happen. What you came to a point where it's like fight or flight, you either had to choose one or the other. Do you think, or I guess a better question is, what would you recommend to someone in that same situation if they should either go all in or still kind of piece it piece by piece? I know you said you don't recommend taking out a bunch of credit cards and going crazy and spending those, but like, what do you recommend to the people that are similar in your shoes? Because there's a lot of people like that.
You know, I would say sit in a room on your own, take a step back from your life and just figure out just how much you have this passion for this, for flying. If your passion for flying, if it's consuming everything in your brain, then you might as well get on with it because you only have one shot at this life. So time is passing by, and I would say do anything you possibly can to move on and get on with it. If you have a vague interest in flying, then do everything you can to go get your private and enjoy flying. But if you really want to go and make this a career, gauge your own passion. Because it's going to be a hard road, but gauge your own passion. And if it's up there, if this is really what you want to do, go for it. Time is passing by. That's what I would recommend. But I wouldn't say go get a bunch of credit cards. I would research some other options maybe.
Yeah, either way, it's expensive. You got to figure it out. And it's still cheaper in the United States than in the UK to go flying. So if you live over in a different country, come on over. There's a lot of companies that specifically do that, whether it's Florida, California. They kind of focus on foreign students and help you convert your license or your ratings, or they help you get your hours.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many now. In fact, where I still fly a little GA and on the airfield in Thermal, California, there's a place there. It's some Belgian guys that run a really, really nice flight school for Europeans specifically. There's another one in Tracy, California that, they encourage people to come over and do this, and they make it easy and fun. You know, these European guys get to come over and they're flying to Vegas and they're flying to the Grand Canyon and they're doing all of these, you know, really cool things. And all the time they're building logbook hours. And of course, San Diego Flight Training is still in business. So yeah, it's a good thing to do.
I love how you said fun, because flight training so many times can just turn into kind of monotonous and it's just go out and do stalls, do steep turns, and you can kind of lose the fun of it. And I feel like 141 is more designed, obviously, to get you done as fast as possible to follow this track. There's not as much room to kind of deviate from the plan. We're 61, go build your time however you can. Go do stalls for a little bit and then go fly around. Go do circles. You literally can kind of pave your own path to get your ratings. And I just think it's very important to always keep the fun in aviation, because later in your career and when you're training and you learn that being a pilot is fun, will help you out when you are actually flying a 737 or an Airbus, when you're doing the same thing over and over again and you kind of lose that fun a little bit for a little. There's always that one moment where it kind of feels like a job, but then you can remember that, hey, this is still fun. I get to fly. I get to do this. Or there's a lot of people who just look at it and they're like, man, this is bull crap. Like, we got to do, the company's making us do this. The company's making us do that. But it's like, always keep that fun in aviation. It will get you through so many of the hard times and it'll keep you loving your job.
Absolutely. And I think that if you find, you know, again, from what we were saying before, if you find yourself very quickly, if you find yourself thinking that your flying training in the early stages is a chore and is just too much and it's not enjoyable and you're not having fun, then you might want to just get out because, you know, you're going to have to keep a good attitude if you're going to head into a career, because there are going to be so many ups and downs that if you spot the early signs of frustration that's leading to just not enjoying the process, then something has to change. Either you know, I would have to change my attitude, or I'd have to change the flight school, or I'd have to change something to make sure that I was, you know, this is a lot of money that you put into this. at least you got to enjoy it. Not every single lesson. I mean, of course, there are frustrations, and I struggle with several things. But then if you're struggling with something, there's a goal to achieve something, to get it right. And that should give you pleasure. That should be, another fun thing to do. So, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Another kind of interesting question. What did you think of the differences in culture at the time between the aviation community in the UK and the aviation community in the United States? Was there a really glaring difference between the two? Or could you kind of consider if you woke up the next day in San Diego, you kind of felt the same way that they felt about aviation?
Oh, they couldn't be more different in my mind. In the UK, I didn't know any different until I came to the US and realized just how free the US airspace system was. As an example, one of the first flights I took in San Diego was a night flight, a night instrument flight to Phoenix. I think it was Williams Gateport or something like that. And I was in the Dutchess and we're flying along and my instructor was just trying to gauge, where I was. And so he said, okay, go shoot an ILS approach. Okay, great. Shoot the ILS approach. And we get to the minimums and I look up and there's nothing there. It's just black. So I went around and he said, why did you go around? I said, because I didn't see the runway. And he said, well, you've got to turn the lights on. And that is the first time I've ever realized that I had to turn the lights on, because in the UK, you have to pay somebody to turn the lights on. There has to be someone at the airport who's going to charge you for using the lights. You just couldn't turn up at an airport without speaking to anyone, without alerting anyone. And then to get to that airport, you would have to squeeze your way around and under and over different pieces of airspace. And of course, every approach that you shoot in the UK, you have to pay for. The first thing you do before you go an instrument fly is you call the control tower of the place that you want to go and practice instrument approaches, and you give them a credit card number. To come over here and number one, just walk out to an airplane, turn on the runway lights, taxi out, get it into the air, and think, right, where should we go? That's so alien compared to the UK. And it was really refreshing, really refreshing. The differences were staggering. And of course, the other thing is in San Diego, the new thing for me was flying near a mountain, and not a mountain as in the UK version of a mountain, which is 3,000 feet high. This was a mountain that was 10,000 feet high, and a very big difference. It just blew me away. It was just such an amazing experience. And it was a lot of fun. It really was. But unfortunately, the UK, I think, is still in the same place. It is very, very restrictive. It's very hard to get instrument approaches or instrument approach practice. If you fly IFR, which of course the UK is a great place for IFR flying, you have to pay for it, and it's a pay per mile. And so the cost becomes so huge that it prices out most people, unless you can afford your own airplane or you can, you have some other source of income. It's closed off to so many people that could have had a career in aviation. Which is such a shame.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. And it makes you feel, or it makes you realize how lucky that you are, or not you, but everyone living in the United States has the opportunity to go fly. And like you said, just go do it. It's not really out there in other countries. And I mean, there might be some country that's similar, but I am assuming, off the top of my head, I can't really think of one. but it also is kind of scary because who knows what the GA world could turn into. And they make more restrictions every single year, every other couple of years. And we hope that they keep the freedom alive. And it's just something that we can't take for granted because you don't know how long it's going to be here and the way it is. So hope for the best, right?
Yeah. I've been seeing that system, that's why I'll wave the flag for AOPA and for EAA and all of these organizations that really try and, try and keep an eye on these regulations so that it doesn't go that way, because the freedom that we now get to enjoy in aviation in the US, you cannot compare it. It's how it should be, to be fair. But the mindset is different. A lot of towns in the US, of course, have their own airport to try and encourage people to come into the town and spend their money. Whereas in the UK and other places, it seems to be more of an inconvenience and a noise problem that we don't want those noisy airplanes coming into our town, so close the airport. And it's just a different way of thinking and a little bit short-sighted, I have to say. But there you go.
Absolutely. Let's take a break from today's episode to hear from our sponsor, RAA. Hey guys, Justin here. Did you know that more than 55% of adults don't protect their income with disability insurance? And for pilots like us, with fixed career limits and higher job risk, there's even more riding on missed benefits opportunities than most. But you can take control and full advantage of all valuable benefits your airline offers, starting with free benefit analysis from my partners at RAA. With your free benefits analysis, an advisor specializing in your airline's benefits plan will help tailor an election strategy that best fits your personal needs and goals, including retirement savings, investments, health savings accounts, healthcare and disability coverage, and more. Listen, your benefits aren't just protecting your health. They're critical to protecting your long-term wealth too. But open enrollment is approaching fast and only lasts for a limited time, just like this free benefits analysis offer. So don't wait. Schedule your free benefit analysis today at raa.com/pilot-to-pilot. That's raa.com/pilot-to-pilot. Now back to today's episode.
So now back to your story a little bit. You have that commercial ticket. You're throwing it in a drawer. Mm. What's your mindset? Mm. Are you just like, all right, cool, I'm just going to stay here, keep building hours until, I don't know if you have a visa or whatever it is expires and I'm forced to go back? Or were you kind of figuring out a way like, hey, I kind of like it here, let me see what I can do?
Well, I just wanted to keep flying. I tried my best to just keep on building hours in the UK. As an example, at the little airport that I used to go to, Old Sarum Airfield in Salisbury, I noticed that there were a bunch of private airplanes, Cessnas and Pipers, that were hardly ever flown. And I already knew that if you didn't fly these airplanes, the batteries would eventually go flat. If you didn't get the oil around the engines, it was bad for the engines and this sort of thing. So I went out and found some of these owners and said, look, here's the deal. If you don't use your airplane, it's bad. You have to get the engine up to temperature. You have to charge the battery. Here's what I'm going to do for you. Once a month, I'm going to take your airplane and I'm going to fly it for 45 minutes. I'm going to get everything up to temperature. I'm going to check everything for you. I'm going to tell you if there's anything that needs to be done. I'm going to bring it back in. I'm going to cycle the prop. I'm going to do everything that needs to be done, put it back, cover it up, tie it down, and you can have the peace of mind that your airplane is in good condition, ready for the next time you want to use it. And I had probably five or six airplanes on the airfield that I would do that. And that was just another way of, okay, how can I build hours without actually paying for them? And that was one way to do it. So I was doing this sort of thing, and I bumped into a friend who worked for an Irish carrier at the time. He was a captain for an Irish carrier. And I didn't realize it, but it became obvious that he was planning a route for me to join that airline. He said, well, here's what I need you to do. And as it turned out, he was a management pilot. And eventually came the day where he said, okay, head on over to Ireland. This was in the days before the European harmonization of aviation licenses and regulations. So, you know, he said, well, this is an Irish carrier, so over you go to Dublin, and I need you to get your Irish commercial conversion. And so I went and started the conversion at Weston Airport in Dublin, and then went along to the Irish Aviation Authority and to go and apply for a Irish first class medical. And now this is where the problem started, because a few, maybe 3 years before that, I'd realized that my eyes were deteriorating, and it was because I was wearing these extended wear contact lenses. But because I was broke, I was supposed to be throwing these contact lenses away and buying new packets of contact lenses, but I couldn't really afford to do that. So I was reusing them. And I was obviously, my eyesight was deteriorating. And so I had a good friend who was an eye surgeon, and he said, look, here's the problem. Oxygen is not getting to your eyeball by doing it, but you know, by doing what you're doing, and your eyesight is going to suffer. Why don't you consider doing this LASIK surgery? I thought, oh, okay. Can I afford to do that? At the time, LASIK surgery was brand new in the UK. And I found a place that was offering a buy one, get one free. So, you know, you buy the left eye and they'll give you the right eye for free, just to generate some business. And so, you know, of course, most people would think, no, I'm not going to go to the place that gives you a buy one, get one free laser surgery. But I couldn't afford anything else. And I listened to Andy, my friend, and he said, you really need to do something about this, because either you need to be buying these contact lenses regularly every month, which they were very expensive, or you just stop it now and you fix your eyes and you're good to go. And so I went and got this laser surgery. So now fast forward back to heading into the Irish Aviation Authority, and the first area of European harmonization for JAA, the first area that was put out to all of the aviation authorities was the medical side. So the first thing they tried to do was to harmonize the medical rules and regulations. And unfortunately, these new European rules did not allow laser surgery as a correction for eyesight. The FAA did, but the new rules under JAA did not allow it. And so at the end of the day, having had this ludicrous medical, which I thought was more akin to an astronaut, not an airline pilot, but they said, well, I'm sorry, but we can't issue your medical because you had laser surgery. And I said, well, that seems a bit silly. Do I meet the regular, you know, do I meet the standards? I think I can, I've got the whole eye chart down there. And they said, oh yeah, you meet the standards, but the way that you meet the standards is not acceptable to us. And I thought, well, this makes no sense whatsoever. And I said, so let me get this straight. If I was still wearing contact lenses, you would be okay with that. And they said, yes. I said, okay, that doesn't seem right. It just seems weird. And I went to see the head of the Irish Aviation Medical Medical Division, who was a really, really nice guy. And he said, look, I think this is dumb. You know this is dumb. But unfortunately, you know, we have these new regulations, these JAA regulations. And the regulations are written just on a few pages. It's very black and white. The previous regulations that I was able to use, the Irish national regulations, is a book full of words. I can read into that what I need to read into it to make a good decision. I just can't issue your medical based on these new regulations, but I want to help you to fight it. And I thought, great. Okay. So I've got somebody on my side. But in the meantime, I have to make money. I don't have a job. And, you know, I was thinking that I was heading off to an airline. I'd resigned from my staff theft job. And so I thought, well, I've got to make some money. What am I going to do? It's so vivid. I sat on the steps of a building next to the River Liffey in Dublin. And I was kind of at my lowest low. I just thought, you know, my airline career is gone. You know, the barriers have been put up. Even though people want to try and help, I've got nothing. I've got no job. I've got no possible future. And for some reason, at that point, the story of my childhood hero, Douglas Bader, came into my head. And Douglas was a World War II fighter pilot that he lost his legs. He basically joined the Royal Air Force before the war, and he was an aerobatic display pilot for the Royal Air Force, and he did some low aerobatics and crashed and lost his legs, and so he was initially confined to an office job, and then when the war started, he basically said, well, look, I'm a trained pilot. You need pilots. I'm ready to go. And of course, they said, well, there's nothing in the regulations that say that somebody with artificial legs can fly an airplane. And he set off on a course to try and change that, and did, and became a fighter ace, and was actually shot down and captured and escaped without legs, which is a bit embarrassing, I guess. The guy became a hero to me. And I thought, here's a guy that was in a similar position with medical regulations, but he had no legs. I've just got this, you know, I've got this eyesight thing, but he had no legs, and he ended up getting through. And it was another kick up the bum that just made me, you know, want to just get on with it. And that's when I remembered I have my FAA commercial certificate. What I need to do is to try and find N-registered airplanes in Europe and see if I can do anything for wherever those airplanes are, whatever they need, to try and keep flying. And so I headed out to try and find N-registered airplanes. That led me to Cessna, who were selling their airplanes throughout Europe. When Cessna would in the UK would buy an airplane, they would bring it over from the US. It would be N-registered until it was sold. And once it was sold, it would be flown to the particular country and then re-registered in that country. But in the meantime, it stayed on the N-register. And the sales guy there said, we need a demo pilot. Great. I'm your man. I have an FAA commercial. And so I can demonstrate these. And he said, great. And you can deliver them to these countries when we sell them. Great. So I started to do that, just to make a little bit of money and keep going. And that guy, the sales guy, Dustin, became the new sales manager of a brand new company called Cirrus. So I did the same thing for Cirrus. So I was actually the demo pilot for Cessna and Cirrus in the UK at the same time. And there were some days when I would take a Cessna to an airfield to demonstrate it to a bunch of people. And the next day I would go with a Cirrus. And, you know, like, well, hang on a second. Yesterday you were trying to sell as a Cessna. Today you're trying to sell as a Cirrus. Like, but that led to these longer flights, delivering these airplanes throughout Europe for the dealers. And then one day somebody said, could you take an airplane over to the US? And I said, sure, because that was my job. I was just any job that I could make a little bit of money from, I just said yes and did it. I flew across the Atlantic and took these couple of Aztecs to Florida. Had virtually no idea what I was doing. I did do quite a lot of research, but I just went and did it. And I was, now I know with hindsight, I was very lucky. The weather windows were good, and I didn't have any issues, mechanical issues. But then somebody said, oh, hey, Cirrus need some of their airplanes brought to the UK. Actually, sorry, no, to Holland, to the dealership in Holland. And because I'd already flown a bunch in the Cirruses, I said, yeah, sure. So I turned up in Duluth and jumped in a Cirrus and took it to Holland. And then another one, and then another one, and then another one.
So you got the ferry pretty much brand new airplanes back and forth.
Exactly.
That's amazing. And most ferry pilots, I feel like, are ferrying like planes that they're not sure are going to start. Don't know if they're going to make it all the way over, but you got nice brand new airplanes. That's awesome. That's the way to do it.
I did. And the nice thing was, is that from Duluth to Goose Bay is, you know, it's a good 10 or 11 hour flight. And in that time, you get to see whether there are any issues with this airplane before you set out across the Atlantic. So you actually get that. Now, to be fair, at the same time, I was also taking any other job that I could. And so, you know, as an example, I ferried this old Yak-18 from Lithuania to the UK. And that was a different story. That was horrendous. You know, it was just a mechanical nightmare. And I couldn't read any of the it was put together at an industrial complex. It wasn't even put together at an airport. And so when I turned up to pick up this Yak-18, I said, well, where's the runway? And they said, well, there is no runway. You've got to use the road. Like, what? What do you mean I've got to use the road? They said, okay, that's all right. We'll close off the road for you and you can take off.
Yeah, we do this all the time. You'll be fine. No worries. Yeah.
And I got in this thing. I thought, well, I may have bitten off more than I can chew here. And I got into this Yak, and everything was in Russian. I don't speak Russian. And so this other guy said, hey, I can be your translator if you can take me along. It sounds like a fun trip. I said, yeah, sure. Come on over. So he became my translator. He sat in the right seat, and we took off on the road, and we got as far as Holland. And that was the first time that somebody had asked for our passports. And so I gave them my passport. And of course, the guy that had come from Russia didn't have a passport. they kind of let him go. But when we arrived in the UK, he kind of ran out into the forests and with the immigration people hot behind them.
You probably brought in like a Russian spy, like a number one Russian spy to the UK. Like, yeah. Well, yeah. I'll get this poor soul to bring him in there. That's hilarious.
Yeah, he's a nice guy, though.
Yeah, he's nice. Yeah, I'm sure Russian spies are great. Yeah, great guy. It's funny because I feel like this whole story kind of all comes back to one thing, and that was you showing up at an airport, you being at the airport, kind of making a name for yourself. There's so many other stories of people like to. It seems like you just happened to find good luck, good luck, good luck, but it really was you going out and putting in the hard work, just showing up and being at the airport. And then people knew you, people were recommending you to other people. So it's one of those things of go to the airport as much as you can. You never know when you're going to meet that person that's going to give you the ferry job, that's going to say, yeah, go fly my plane for 45 minutes every month. You know, you never know, but just show up, just be there, and people will look out for you. And in this community specifically, they'll root for you and they will try to find stuff for you.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I worked at the airport just for, you know, almost no wages, but it didn't really matter to me. I fueled airplanes, I cut the grass, I did all of those things purely so that I could tell my silly stories to people, because eventually somebody's gonna have a friend or somebody that needs something done, and they'll say, oh, hang on a minute. I know there's a guy. There's that guy, Steve, at the airport. He's done this. He's done that. Oh, I'll go see him now. And, you know, that without any question, that's you have to be present. You have to be there. People have to see you. It has to exist. And, you know, that's the old quote, right? Build it and they'll come. Well, you can't. You've got to exist. You've got to be there for people to come to you. And so that's for sure. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. And you wrote a book for ferry pilots, right? Or not for ferry pilots, but about your experience being a ferry pilot, right?
Yeah, I did. It wasn't intended to be a book. My dad was later on, once I got into the airlines, I was flying along and I was telling some of my silly ferrying stories. And I have about 10 good stories, because mostly ferry flying is quite boring. It's, you know, very long legs, with moments of craziness or excitement. And you can kind of steal little bits of those and make them into one good little story. And I had about 10 of those, and I would tell these stories to some of the people that I was flying with. And, at the time, my dad was diagnosed with a sort of an Alzheimer's string. It was called Lewy body disease, but kind of an Alzheimer's thing. And I was flying with a guy that I used to fly with a lot, and he said, "You better write some of this stuff down, you know, before you get Alzheimer's." You know, I'm like, "Wow, that's a good point." And then I thought, "Wow, wouldn't it be cool if I wrote these down and then I ended up in the same place as my dad, where if I reread some of these silly stories, and what would I think of me? What would I think of this guy? Would I think he was a lunatic? Would I think, you know, wow, that's really inspirational? Or what would I think as a person that had started to forget these stories?" And so I wrote a few things down, and tried to write a story, and it was okay. It was not great, but it was okay. But there were a couple of lines that I thought, wow, that's actually quite good. And I kept coming back to it, and I kept coming back to it. And over a period of about 3 years, I basically got these 10 stories written down, and I shared them with some people, and they really liked them. But the people that were reading them knew me, and so they said, "Well, these are good stories, but if you were to read this, or somebody that didn't know you was to read this, they don't know, how did you get into this ferrying thing?" And so the story I just told you, I wrote that. To get, you know, why did you, because no one sets out to be a ferry pilot. That's, you know, that's not where you don't aim for that, I don't think, or most people don't. And so how did you get into it is a story in itself. And so I wrote that piece. And then I basically had this, what kind of was a book. And I thought, well, if I self-publish this, number one, I check off my life list of I wrote a book and it's on the shelf. Whether or not anybody ever reads it, it doesn't matter. But I wrote a book, so I can check that off of my life list. But also, the people that are in the people part of the story that may know a small part of it but didn't know the other bits, I can send them a copy of this book and maybe they'll enjoy it. And so I self-published this thing. And of course, as part of self-publishing it, it's automatically put out onto Amazon and Kindle. And what actually happened was a magazine, an aviation magazine in the UK, Flyer Magazine, picked it up and wrote a review, and a very, very nice review. And then another magazine picked it up and wrote another review. And all of a sudden, the book was selling to all of these people that I didn't know, these strangers, and I felt weird. It wasn't ever written for other people, but the comments that I was getting back were really nice. People seemed to enjoy it, seemed to like reading the stories, and so. But then the money started to come in. It wasn't a massive amount of money, but some money was coming in, and I just felt bad. I didn't write it to make money. That wasn't the point. And so I thought, well, to make me feel better, what I should do is I should donate this money to the Douglas Bader Foundation, because Douglas Bader was a reason that I ended up where I ended up. And that makes me, that takes my guilt away. And so I started to donate to the Douglas Bader Foundation. And what they do is they take kids with limb loss And they teach them to fly, or they at least give them an experience of flying, to encourage them, you know, encourage these kids to understand that, you know, if you've lost your arm, let's say, or a leg, you can still fly an airplane. So if you can fly an airplane, you can do anything, you know, even though you've lost this limb, let's say. And I just thought that's it. It's got to go there. And it's almost $12,000 in now.
Wow, that's amazing. Congratulations for selling. That's a lot for a book, man. That's awesome.
It's crazy. Well, that's not just the book. That's there's a lot of other events and things that I've done. I just became, it was just nice to be able to donate to them because I see the work they do. And it was really cool to be able to do that. But then, of course, from the ferrying, I ended up, the ferrying career lasted about 4 years. And one of the last ferry flights I did was three British Aerospace ATPs from the desert in Kingman, Arizona, over to the UK. And the one of the pilots that I got, that I hired to fly those flights, was at the time the fleet manager for Air Wisconsin. And at the time also, I had met my wife, who was American. And so we were planning to get married, and the ferrying it's a very, very dangerous profession. And I kind of got to that point where I would walk up to an airplane and just think, okay, is this one my coffin? You know, and that is not a good way to start a flight. So I just thought I need to, for the sake of my health and for the sake of my future marriage, I need to do something here. And a throwaway comment to John as we're crossing the Atlantic in one of these British Aerospace ATPs ended with his, quit your whining, I'll pay you $20 an hour to fly a CRJ.
And okay, I think I can do it.
That's where I ended up going. I closed down my ferrying business and I went to Air Wisconsin as a $20 an hour CRJ first officer.
Were you making less money doing that than you were with ferries?
Way less. It was ludicrous amounts less. It was nothing to do with the money. It was pure. The money was irrelevant. Honestly, it was, I've got to move to my next, you know, to the next stage. I got to move on from the ferrying. Even though I have had a very successful ferrying business, it could end at any moment with me in a box. And unfortunately, a lot of colleagues that I came into contact with, that's what happened. You know, they ended up in a box. And I said, well, my number is going to be up sooner or later. So for the sake of a schedule in an airline, a good airline, that's what I want. It wasn't about the money. It was nothing to do with money. And so I joined Air Wisconsin.
Yeah, and that's the next logical step to fulfill your dream of being an airline pilot or flying bigger metal or kind of continuing your progress. Like everyone kind of gets in the situation where maybe they get their first job or their second job and they're making a decent amount of money. They're making good money, but it's still not their end goal. But they're in this position and this mindset of, well, I'm making pretty good money. I can live off this. Like, I can live off this. This is something I like to do. I could see myself, the people are nice to me. And they're hesitant to take that next step. They're hesitant to either take that pay cut. Well, it's not much of a pay cut anymore now because regionals actually pay pretty well. But you still find yourself like maybe you owe the company you're at more than you think you do. Like you stay longer than you need to. But in reality, you need to get to the next job. You need to keep moving. You need to constantly be going for the end goal, whether it's to fly fractional, whether it's to fly for the airlines or whatever it is, like constantly move. Don't feel like you owe anyone anything or don't be afraid to make less money to further pursue your end goal and your end dream.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. Yeah, that was So the regional stuff was, you know, I enjoyed it a lot. I really enjoyed my time at Air Wisconsin. Great people, hard flying, you know, northeast flying, wintertime, summertime, and then upgrade. And then I was offered a position in the training department, so I went to the training department and became a check airman. And then I, you know, I was able to get that thrill of helping people that were struggling in the sim. Then I became an APD, and all of this time I was back in this, oh, people are leaving for majors and people are going to airlines and I'm not, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing, but I feel as if I probably should move on, but you know, I don't know. And I, at the time, it was the time of the US Air America West merger. And I was riding jump seat to work a lot. And I saw how miserable the flight decks were. And I thought, I do not want to come into this environment. I don't care what they would pay. I don't want to come into an environment like this. And so I avoided the majors for a really long time until on my doorstep, we were living in the Bay Area at the time, on my doorstep, Virgin America opened up. And that to me was, aha, this is not miserable. This is not dull. This is not boring. This is not routine. This is something new. This is something different. This is something I could have fun with. I could, you know, even if it doesn't last very long, this is going to be fun. And so I walked into an interview, not really expecting to get the job, but to, you know, I just wanted to see what it was all about. It sounded exciting to me. And I got the job about 6 months after Virgin started to fly. And yeah, that was the next bit.
It's pretty much like the best way you could bring UK to the Bay Area almost, like, because it's like Virgin, UK founded, right? Is it UK founded or technically the islands, Richard Branson and everything like that, but UK kind of upbringing and kind of ideology and just airline to the Americas. Then it was kind of your way of being flying for a carrier in the UK, but in the States. So it's kind of cool that that worked out.
It's very weird. Yeah. I mean, I grew up with Virgin products and they were always in the same way as San Diego Flight Training. They always seemed to take away the small print. They were always upfront about things. You knew what you were going to get. And you expected that people were going to be generally happy. And the focus was on customer service. And so I just thought this, you know, and they did some things that more regular, you know, businesses wouldn't do, you know. It seemed like they would always do these crazy events and have fun. And they would always involve the employees. And I just thought, if it's anything like the Virgin that I know from the UK, I know this is going to be fun. Now, I also had a realization that the airline industry in the US, it probably weren't going to be very happy about this. Because if it became successful, it would be something that would really challenge and take a lot of money away from these established airlines. And so I didn't know if it was going to last. But at the time, I had nowhere else I wanted to go because of the misery in some of these flight decks. And so for me, it was pretty obvious. That's where I want to go just to be a part of it. And so that's what I did. And that led to 13 years on the Airbus. And then in 2016, Alaska Airlines bought Virgin America. And so by default now, I'm an Alaska Airlines pilot and transitioned to the 737 last year. And that's now my day job, which is kind of cool.
Was there any inkling of like when you were at Virgin, did you think was there a moment like, hey, we either need to merge, be bought, or it's going to go under? Was that kind of the feeling for a while?
Well, here's a funny thing. So I joined Virgin in 2008. And 2008 was, if you remember, was the financial crisis. And I thought, well, that's it. We're done. But we weren't. There were people throwing money at this airline. Because it seemed to be making a difference. I mean, I saw the passengers. I spoke to the passengers, and people really seemed to connect with it, and they really liked it. And we had a really good team of people. It, everybody I worked with, most of them are now lifelong friends. And the passengers could see that we were all happy and we were together. And so when we were able to get through 2008, I thought, you know, really, is there anything that can stop this? Now, we grew at a rapid rate. We never really made that much money, but we didn't really lose that much either. And the investors were always willing to put money in. But then at some point, just prior to the acquisition from Alaska, at some point there was just too much money available on the table, and so that's where, you know, as an employee, it's, you know, I'm out of this. This is about people much higher up than me that have lots of dollar signs in front of them.
Yeah, let's see what Steve says. Steve, do you want this merger to go through?
Would you like this to happen? And unfortunately, I also think that's what Richard Branson was in a similar position, because as a UK citizen, he was not able to be a shareholder of 51%. So he couldn't make an overall decision either on the sale of the company. And so, you know, it was left to American investors who could make that 51% decision. And it was sold. And there you go. Alaska acquired Virgin America.
It's funny, when you were at Air Wisconsin, you were jump seating to and from work, and you were in an environment where there was a merger going on. You knew US Airways and America West, and you thought to yourself, I don't want to ever be a part of this situation. And then you go to Virgin, and then here you are facing a merger. Now I'm asking this because what I'm guessing there are differences between the two. My dad is an American pilot, flew for US Airways, started with Piedmont, and he's seen a bunch of mergers going up to where he is now. But what could you tell any differences between the Alaska and Virgin merger versus US Airways and America West? Now, US Airways America West merger was probably one of the worst mergers in mentality, how it was implemented. Just everything just seemed to go wrong, and no one liked each other, it seemed like. But I'm guessing it was a little bit different on the West Coast side.
Yeah, I have to say, the memories of that US Air America West merger just came flooding back when we were told in 2016 that we were merging, and I just thought, oh man, this is going to be horrible. You know, I just don't know what to expect. But to be fair, let's see, how can I put this? Virgin and Alaska had some similar operational issues in terms of basic things that as pilots we would pay attention to, for example, schedules, time off, flexibility with schedules, these kinds of things. They were a little challenging at Virgin. And when we learned the new system at Alaska, it was also a little challenging there. And so we had a little bit of common ground. We also had a seniority integration that wasn't too bad. There were kind of pissed off people on one side and pissed off people on the other, which probably means it was a wrong that they merged the seniority lists. And so there was no real spark that drove it down the same road as the America West and US Airways merger. We really just didn't have that. And so, in fact, one of the things that I do remember, one of the first times that the two pilot groups got together, we had big company meeting over several days. All of the employees came in, and you know, so that the company could lay out the future plans, and so you could get to talk to the leadership and things like this, and it was all good. But in the evening, the union had put on, they had a couple of hotel rooms, and they had some beers, and they had some snacks, and they said to the pilots of both pilot groups, Virgin and Alaska, come in and have some beers and hang out. And when you take those uniforms off and you have a pair of jeans on and a t-shirt and a beer, you start to talk. And we realize very quickly that we're just pilots. This is nothing to do with us. You know, all of these decisions were made by, they weren't made by pilots. They were made by the uppers, you know, the management people. We just turn up. Nobody knew that, when I joined Virgin, I didn't know that Alaska was going to be my future employer. When somebody joined Alaska, they didn't know that they were, you know, Alaska were going to buy Virgin. It was just nothing to do with us. We just turn up and do the job. There really was very little toxic environment. There was nothing like the America West and US Air merger, which was really, really nice. And you know, Alaska is a good company. I like Alaska. I like working for them. And especially recently during this pandemic, the one thing that Alaska has is money. And they're very conservative and very careful with their money. And they had money in the bank. And that, again, as two previously separate pilot groups, kind of brought us together. You know, we were all thrown into the same situation. And these things were figured out for one pilot group. And, you know, the benefit of working for a company that had some money in the bank and a very unified union as well kind of worked for all of us. So, it's been a pretty decent process, actually.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's a constant theme in your story and a lot of people's stories, just like constant adversity and getting to the end goal and constantly having maybe a goal and taking the side paths along that instead of going straight from A to B, you're taking like A.1, A.2, and you're going off to the side to eventually get back to that end goal. But it's constant in almost everyone's story. It's like, take the best opportunity you have at that time to further your career and further your life and further yourself personally, financially or spiritually or mentally, whatever it needs to be to get to that end goal to where you want to go. And you never know where it's going to be. And when the hard times come, there will be hard times. Some hard times are different than others. Some people face really true tragedies. Some people deal with demons inside themselves. And you just have to constantly take every day step by step and work through it and get through it. And it's going to end and it's going to lead to a great career in aviation with a couple downturns financially, whatever it is, mergers. But you just got to stick to it. And like we said earlier, you got to remember the love you have for this industry. Remember the love you have for aviation and that you truly can't see yourself doing anything else.
Well, that, I mean, it's so true. And actually, to be fair, you know, working for Virgin and for Alaska has gifted me the opportunity to get back into GA and own an airplane, own a couple of airplanes, which is from where I came from is just nuts. In a million years, I never, ever thought I would be able to do that. And so going back to GA flying now has been so refreshing because it's just reminded me of the fun flying, of that opportunity that we have to get into the air with the freedom that we have to fly around and go visit these towns and go visit these places. And my wife got her private and she got her instruments. So now we're able to fly together and enjoy flying. And so when I come to work, the job itself can have days of tedium and boredom and, frustration and other things. But, that's when you got to step back, I think, and just remind yourself just how lucky, you know, I am to be in this position because I know that there's another 1,000 people that would do this. Is it? You know, and those are the people that have got to decide on their passion. And hopefully I get to fly with them or when I'm retired, I'll be their passenger. And that's how it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great industry and not everyone has the opportunity to get into it, whether it's just failure on aviation's part for seeming like it's an old boys club where they don't do a good enough job of kind of promoting it to everyone and being like, hey, literally anyone can do this. It doesn't matter who you are, what you believe, what you want to do. You can be a pilot. And whether it's just
fault by that. Like, we are just the lucky ones that are in the situation, and it's our duty to help other people get into it and find this as well. So enjoy what you have, because there's so many people that would love to be doing what you're doing. And remember when you were a CFI or a ferry pilot, where all you wanted to do is go fly these routes that you are now flying?
Yeah. I pinch myself so many times. It's, you know, just to sit there every now and again and just look out the window and think, man, I in my lifetime, I never thought I'd see San Francisco or Los Angeles or Hawaii. I never thought I'd ever visit those places. And now, you know, I'm looking out of a hotel window now at Upper Manhattan. That's nuts. That's absolutely nuts. You know, it's now so normal. But I don't want to take it for granted.
What would 9-year-old Steve say to current Steve right now? Like, holy crap, how did you get here? I never imagined this. Like, what would that conversation be like?
Oh, well, I'd be, as a 9-year-old, I would be questioning myself. I mean, it's just so impossible. It's not even realistic. It's a different world. It's a different planet, from where I came from. But I think my 9-year-old self would say, you know, obviously you did it. So keep going, I guess. Yeah.
I have some rapid fire questions for you. It is just aviation themed questions. And if you listen to almost 200, I'm sure you have some answers. So I'm ready
now,
for them.
Here's a funny thing. So I have listened to almost 200 of these, and I play along with this, but every time I change my answers. So this is going to be interesting, because I don't know what I'm going to say.
So they are set in stone after this, and you can never change them ever again. Yeah. So this is your last chance. You ready?
Yep. I'm ready.
All right. What is your favorite airplane ever made?
Supermarine Spitfire.
That was quick. I like it. All right. Corporate jet.
That won't change. Corporate jet.
Always trick up the airline pilots with the corporate jets.
Falcon 900.
Ooh, all right. Cool. What about favorite GA airplane?
De Havilland Chipmunk.
All right. What's the ugliest airplane you've ever seen?
Okay, this one I do know. It is an airplane I flew once, and it's called a Gardan Horizon GY80.
GY80. I'm going to look it up real quick.
Gardan,
I got to see this.
It's GARDAN. Gardan Horizon. It is
80 aircraft.
Awful. And yeah, it flies as well as it looks.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's funny. All right. It truly amazes me how many ugly airplanes there actually are that have been made. There is literally a million of them. And I just hate on the Piaggio for no real reason.
Yeah. Although I agree with you that. I really do.
Thank you. I appreciate it. All right. Here's another one. What's something you wish you knew before you became a pilot?
How to iron a shirt.
Dude, that's
no
a struggle.
No one ever told me that.
Yeah. Or like to mentally prepare yourself to do it the night before, so you're not rushing in the morning.
Yeah.
I always do it every single time. I'll have like 5 minutes to iron my shirt, and it could look so much better if I just took the time at night to do it.
It's so true.
Every time. Who's someone in the industry you would love to meet most? Could be living or they could have died.
Actually, that one's easy for me. That's Douglas Bader. My inspiration, my hero. And he passed away in the early 80s. And I would love to sit down and chat to him. As a result of donating the money to the foundation, I've got to become friends with his living relatives. And it's so fascinating to talk to them. I would love to sit down and talk to him.
I love it. Yeah, that'd be cool. I've never heard that story before. That's crazy.
Oh, there's a book and a movie called Reach for the Sky by Paul Brickhill. If you ever get the chance, it's an old 1950s movie, but it's absolutely my favorite movie.
You have to check it out.
Reach for the Sky. Yeah.
All right. Next question. What's your overall favorite thing about aviation?
The people. 100%.
What's your least favorite flight you've ever flown?
Least favorite. I think it was probably an Airs Thrush, an ag plane, that I was ferrying from Alabama to Portugal. And that thing was just so shaky, and I just had so many things happen on that flight. And it ended it never got to Portugal, with me flying anyway. It ended in St. John's, Newfoundland, with a freak windstorm that damaged the airplane. It ripped the control lock out, and the ailerons and elevators were flapping so much that they flapped themselves off of the... It was ludicrous, the winds that were kicking up. And it was completely unforecast. And that, going back out to see that airplane and the damage, I cannot even tell you how I felt, because I just felt so bad, deflated, defeated, a failure. I really, really, really affected me bad, because I had 100% delivery record, and I was always really proud of, you know, the leg before I would ultimately deliver the airplane. Even if it was just a dealer, I would clean the airplane. I would make it look nice. I'd make sure the logbooks were all in the right place. And, you know, I wanted to keep a bit of pride in the delivery. And that one was just to see this wreck. And it was on my watch. Was just awful. I hated it.
Yeah, that is awful. And it just goes to show how crazy aviation can be and unpredictable. Yeah. Unprecedented winds when you don't expect it. Not fun. Not a good time.
No, definitely not.
What's your favorite flight you've ever flown?
I'm gonna say that was probably a recent flight that I flew. Because I'm in that stage in my career now where I really am enjoying every flight. And I got to do my line check from Los Angeles to Maui, which is one of my favorite places ever, one of my favorite approaches. And the Czech airman was an ex-Blue Angel. He was Blue Angel 2 from the early 90s. And the FO was also a former military pilot. And that flight was, even though it was a line check, was just awesome.
That's pretty cool. Turn a line check into an awesome flight. Doesn't happen very often.
No, not really. But what a fascinating guy. Well, both of the people in that cockpit. I was so privileged to share the cockpit with them. And the flight itself, you know, the flight was good. The approach was really good, and a pretty decent landing as well.
That's the best part. What's your favorite airport you've ever landed at?
I think DCA. Yeah, I love the river vision into DCA.
What's your least favorite airport?
Newark.
Would you rather fly IFR or VFR?
VFR.
You're at the airport and you have about 30 minutes in between your next flight. What food are you going for?
If there is one, Chipotle.
All right. I will never eat Chipotle ever again in my life. I got sick about it 6 months ago. I got food poisoning and I will never eat it ever again. Ever.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Chipotle. What we got? Would you rather fly over mountains, beaches, or the city?
Mountains.
Airbus or Boeing? Specifically, you've flown both.
I got to say, I there are things I love about both and there are things I hate about both. But if we're talking just flying, it's got to be Boeing.
All right.
For if it's just work, it's got to be Airbus.
There we go. I'll take it. What's your favorite airline livery?
Virgin America.
All right. Long trips or short trips? And all I mean long, I mean you're taking the 737 on the longest flight you can possibly do. The longest flight. Or if you're taking the 737 on as many short trips you could possibly do in a day. So you're doing like the shuttle in the Northeast, like 8 times a day or 6 times a day. What would you choose?
Normally I would have said long, but I, as part of the transition to the Boeing with Alaska, I got to fly the Milk Run in Southeast Alaska, which are really short flights through Southeast Alaska, through the mountains and to short runways and quick turns. And that was so cool.
That's awesome.
So I'm going to say short trips. Yeah,
it's like a little part of fractional aviation up there. Quick turns, air mountains, small airports. Yeah.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Very fun. It's amazing what these planes are actually capable of when you take them outside of like a 10,000 foot airport or 10,000 foot runway, you know, like what these machines can truly do and how quick they can stop. It's like really crazy when you see it in action.
Yeah, it's when that was when I really clicked with the 737. It was obvious. It's just a really good airplane. It's just a normal, it's just an airplane. Just go fly. It was great.
What's the biggest win of your career so far?
I think meeting John, who was the fleet manager of Air Wisconsin, because that really, that took me away from the Farian, which was, I would never change it. It was the best education I could ever have of the world and of cultures and of people. But it took me away from something that was potentially going to end badly and put me onto this track that has now led to, you know, a career that I can end doing the sort of things that I'm doing, you know, out to the islands and down to Mexico and out to New York.
What's the biggest regret of your career, if you have one?
Because of where I'm sitting, I really can't say that I have one. I needed all of those bad things to happen to open up the doors to the good things. They had to happen. And it's now why, even if there's something bad that happens, I just let it go. I let it happen because I know it's going to lead to something good. So I don't think I can really regret anything.
That's a good way to look at it. As long as you can learn from all the bad things and you can let them take you to a place that not ruining your life or kind of you constantly thinking about it, and you can let it push you to become a better person and strive for the best opportunity, then it's definitely, I consider those wins. So that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we got a couple more. CRJs or ERJs? Let's say you're commuting on a CRJ 200 or a 145. What would you choose?
I can't believe you're asking me these questions. I've listened to this so many times and I keep going backwards and forwards, but I'm saying CRJ.
All right. Yeah, the 145 is pretty terrible. Now, if there's any ERJ, if it's a 175, give me that any day of the week. Yeah, that's one of my favorite planes to fly on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Piper or Cessna? What would you choose?
Piper.
141 training or 61 training?
61.
And your overall...
Actually, I'm going to say 61 unless you have a really good instructor for 141.
All right. I like that. It's fair, fair. Overall, favorite airline. So this would be, it can't be Virgin America because it's not in existence anymore. Mm-hmm. But if you're getting two tickets to fly anywhere in the world or you're flying standby and you're going back home, what are you trying to go on for business class or whatever it could be?
Lufthansa.
I like it. All right. Last question I have for you. There's someone listening to this that's in a very similar situation as you. Maybe they're in South of London or the South of UK. And they just really want to be a pilot. They don't have the money to go. Just go do it. They don't see a route for them, or it could be anyone, anywhere in the world. What would you recommend to them right now? Maybe three tips that helped you that you look back on and you think were just like fundamental things for you to become where you are today and become the person you are today.
Yeah. So the first thing is, if you're thinking of a career in aviation, try your best to ignore the career in the future and enjoy getting your private, because getting your private should be an enjoyable process. Learning to fly should be enjoyable. Forget about the career until after you've got the private. Once you've got the private, you'll know whether or not you're going to continue with it as a career. So just enjoy the training of the private first. If you get into the industry, this is the second tip. Remember, this is a really small industry. No ego, and don't piss anybody off, because the next guy you piss off is going to be the next person that could open a door to somewhere that you want to go. So just remember, it's a real small industry. And then once you're established in the industry, I think the best advice I can give is, because it's such a up and down industry with so many peaks and troughs, make a decision on whether, you know, an airline, a position, or whatever it happens to be, and stick with it for 5 years. Don't change anything for 5 years. And let the peaks and troughs during that 5 years, however long you want to do this, but I would say five. Let the peaks and troughs happen, the good times, the bad times, and then at the end of the years, decide whether or not you want to do another five. And whether you want to change airlines, whether you want to change career, but if you decide that you're doing another 5 years, stick with it and then go through the ups and downs that will inevitably occur during that next 5 years and see how you feel at the end of it.
Perfect. I love it. Steve, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was a lot of fun talking with you. You have a crazy story, man. I'm really excited that you came on to share that. And I really think it's going to resonate now with people and just kind of hear just there's different ways to go about the career and just to constantly search or not search, but constantly just take what's next, you know, go to the airport, go show up, go do your work and good things happen. So it's really cool to talk to you and I wish you nothing but the best. And maybe one day we can have you back on to talk more fairy stories. I'm sure there's a ton more stories that you could share.
Yeah, there's a lot. I don't mind promoting this because, again, it goes to the charity, but the book is called Rubber Suits and Lukewarm Soup. It's some silly, crazy stories. Grab that.
Like you said, go do it. Go grab it. But yeah, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. That's a wrap on today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. And like the ad said, it is open enrollment season and make sure you're reaching out to RAA. They can help you out in every way. They'll help you make the right decision. So Aviation, check out RAA. You can go to the link in the bio and they will help you out. Make your life really easy. It's amazing. That's all I have for you today. And as always, happy flying. Pilot to Pilot LLC is compensated to make recommendations to his or her followers regarding the services of RAA or Allworth Airline Advisors, companies of Allworth Financial, LP, or Allworth. Promoter is not an employee or investment advisor representative of Allworth. Promoter is a current client of Allworth. Allworth-based promoter fee of $4,000 a month for sponsorship of the Pilot to Pilot podcast. Due to the compensation arrangement between Allworth and promoter, promoter has an incentive to recommend Allworth, resulting in material conflict of interest. Promoter's role on behalf of Allworth is limited strictly to making recommendations regarding the services of Allworth, introducing or referring prospective clients to Allworth. Promoter has no responsibility with respect to Allworth's investment advisor or other advisory services.